Football Weekly is on the
Hi, this is Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm and Mike Wilkening. It is our great pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where every week we bring you all of the inside scoops and rumors from around the National Football League.
We dissect the latest in the Saints bounty case. We also try to figure out what's going on inside the head of Percy Harvin.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us again this week for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I am Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor at PFW. I am joined by my co-host, senior editor Eric Edholm, and co-anchoring with us this week from the Pro Football Weekly studios on the PFW hotline is senior editor Mike Wilkening. And guys, before we get to some of the team-specific NFL way we hear it, I think we need to wrap up for a lot of our audience what is a remarkably confusing situation as to what is going on with Bountygate and the NFL these days. And specifically, it was the hearing this past Monday of the appeals of, I'm going to say, three of the four suspended players, because Will Smith and Scott Fujita and Anthony Hargrove agreed to speak together with Roger Goodell. Apparently, Jonathan Vilma showed up with his own attorney. They got partway into a conversation, and then Vilma decided to leave, felt that the whole thing was a farce. One thing that all four players have agreed on is that this is a farce, and I'm going to weigh in as the publisher of Pro Football Weekly and say it's even a bigger farce than what these players are saying. And here's the problem, guys. In our country, in our court system, we have trial courts and we have appellate courts. So without commenting on things I don't know anything about, because I haven't seen any of the alleged evidence, unfortunately too many people haven't seen the evidence, but let's assume that there is all the evidence that Roger Goodell in the league office says there is, and that these guys did something wrong and they deserve to be punished. I'm good with all that. I'm willing to wait and hear that. But to say that they're entitled to an appeal and have the appeal heard by the same guy who issued the ruling in the first place, it's un-American. I mean, call it whatever else you want, but you've got to have a neutral arbiter to hear the appeal, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is, I'm going to crush the union for a little bit, and we've been doing a little bit of this offseason as we look at the CBA that they signed for the next, you know, 9+ years that they're sort of glued to. You know, a flat salary cap, that's pretty bad. But the fact that these player suspensions and these things that you're talking about, the appeal system, the fact that they couldn't get this where somebody else other than Roger Goodell is hearing these appeals, to me, is a major, major loss. Because the players that I spoke to before the lockout, this was something very high on their list. Yes, they wanted security. Yes, they wanted money. Yes, they wanted all these things that short careers in the NFL don't always bring them. But they also wanted their thoughts to be heard by somebody other than Roger Goodell, who's had a heavy hand in these things. And I think that was something that the union just didn't take seriously or let go too easily in the negotiation process.
Well, Mike, as we've talked about the various, you know, debating or negotiating points of this CBA, I have said repeatedly the one that probably upset me the most was DeMaurice Smith and the players agreeing to give up judicial oversight of this collective bargaining agreement. There is nothing in this agreement that allows a player to go to court. Now, Jonathan Vilma has filed suit against Roger Goodell and the NFL. We don't know if the courts are even going to agree to hear that case, but the bottom line here is that whether you like the way that Goodell is handling it or not, and I don't, he seems to be entitled to do it because of what the players have given up in negotiations.
This all goes back to the negotiations of, you know, 2011 and before that for this new CBA, and it raises the question, you know, obviously the perception being that the players didn't get a great deal in this last round negotiations. And I know it's a long way down the pike here, but when you look at what negotiations could be in 9 years or thereabouts with so many hot-button issues, now, obviously, I think the waters could calm a little bit before that point, but you have to wonder that this is going to be a hot-button issue and also, obviously, getting an ever bigger piece of the revenue pie in the next negotiation. So while it's a long deal, and I don't think it's a great deal for the players, you know, from a labor peace standpoint, at least we're guaranteed of having the game of football on the field here for a while, because I've got to tell you, the way this has started out the first year of this agreement, it's going to be very interesting to see how things unfold here in 2020 or thereabouts.
Well, and here's the really interesting piece of this, guy. A lot of the conversation debate this week has been about the due process and the process itself. The players and the union complaining about the lack of evidence, the lack of information being turned over to them. It seems pretty clear to me from reading the CBA that the league doesn't have to give them anything.
That's right. Yep.
That's not the issue as to how the league is handling the evidence. The issue is that the Players Association gave them the right to do whatever they want. What troubles me about this is I look at Roger Goodell and the NFL owners. When is a win big enough? Okay? You've got all this power. You've got all this authority. You've made your point for the good of the game. But now you make yourself look silly and petty by saying, I'm going to be the judge, jury, and executioner. I'm the only one who's going to be able to handle this. To me, guys, Eric, Roger Goodell would do himself and the game a tremendous service by saying, you know what? We're going to be magnanimous. We're going to be the good guys here. Yeah. We're going to set up this three-person arbitration panel, or we'll just pick another former player as an independent arbiter and let him hear it. Because at this point, you've already made the point you wanted to make in the first place.
I get that, but I also think that the NFL is not in any mood to do the union any favors at this point. Yeah. You know, despite the fact there's labor peace, so to speak, these two sides still don't get along. They disagree about stuff left and right. If anything, in the last 6 months, I would say there's been less harmony, more disagreement between the two sides. And, you know, I blame D. Smith to a certain degree, because this is a guy with a political background and a legal background, somebody who understands, you know, Capitol Hill, and he understands contract law. And he should have known that what you're talking about, the oversight stuff, I mean, that was one of their most powerful assets, the fact they could go up to Minnesota and win court cases against the NFL. To give that up and to not have this appeal system heard by somebody else, that to me was a major, major loss, and they should have known better. If they didn't get salary cap where they wanted, I can understand that. They're not financial guys necessarily. But to lose this major, major weapon that they used to wield, to me, that's just a huge loss.
All right, guys, we're going to take a very quick commercial break here. We're going to hear from Dan Parr in just a moment. Dan actually covers the New Orleans Saints for us. It's become a non-Saints issue now. It's a league-wide embarrassment, but we'll hear how it's impacting the Saints in just a moment. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly, everybody. Hub Arkish and Eric at home anchoring for you this week in studio. Mike Wilkening is anchoring on the PFW hotline, but right now we've got Dan Parr out of the office doing some work, and Dan covers the NFC South for us as well as the Chicago Bears, so we want to welcome him. And I'm following up this conversation, Dan, about what's really become an embarrassment to the league, the Saints, and everybody else as far as Roger Goodell's handling of the suspensions of the four current and former Saints players, the appeal process, the lack of due process. What if any, is the impact at this point in New Orleans? I guess the latest is Joe Vitt has offered to take a lie detector about something to do with the bounty program. You almost have a sense that the Saints would be a lot better off if everybody would just drop it, take their punishment, and move forward.
Yeah, Joe Vitt is now coming out, and after being fairly quiet on the issue for a while, issuing some vehement denials and questioning the authenticity of the evidence the NFL laid out for players at a recent appeal hearing about the suspension. And yes, no word yet on whether Roger Goodell will take him up on that offer for the lie detector test. I think we all have a pretty good idea to what the answer will be, but it's going to be a thing throughout the season, and certainly when they get back for training camp, it's a storyline for the Saints. They'll be answering questions about that. Will it be a distraction? I don't know. I think Joe Vitt hopes that this is something the team will use as motivation and, you know, during a time when they're a little bit shorthanded, are able to maybe get them through some tough times together. But it's a situation that isn't going away. It's still a big story.
You know, Dan, I'm confused by the position that Vitt is taking, because he's got a 6-week suspension. He appealed it. He either has lost that appeal or is going to lose that appeal. By offering to take this test, is he denying that he had anything to do with a bounty program at all?
He has said that the Saints never targeted players with a specific intent to injure them. He has, you know, said that, you know, the language that the NFL has used, talking about card off hits, you know, he says those are legal hits. There's nothing illegal about that. I don't know exactly what he intends to prove with the lie detector test, but he apparently has something in mind that he would like to reveal that proves what the Saints are saying, what the approach he's taking. He's telling the truth about this whole situation. While, he doesn't want that perception to be out there that all these denials are a bunch of hogwash.
Yeah, and guys, I'm not commenting on Joe Vitt in one way or another, but the bottom line is you only get carted off the field if you've been injured. And so if guys were being rewarded for getting guys carted off the field, there's no way you could spin the semantics to suggest that that wasn't an intent to injure. But at this point, I keep saying let's let the process play out. Unfortunately, the process isn't playing out. And part of the problem, as we've been discussing, is I'm not sure that the NFL has a real process so much as they just want everybody to take the commissioner at his word and accept that as law. We shall see what happens. Dan, let's talk about some real football. The Carolina Panthers, one of the surprise teams in the NFL last year. 2 years ago, even though they were a bad football team, a lot of people would have said best offensive line in football. Jordan Gross at one tackle, Jeff Oda on the other side, Travell Wharton still playing real well inside, Ryan Khalil at center. Well, all that's kind of come apart now, and the guy who I thought was going to be the sturdiest for the long haul, Jeff Oda, appears to be the guy, you know, best case trying to get out of Ron Rivera's doghouse right now.
That's right. I mean, everything you hear from Ron Rivera is he doesn't have much confidence that Jeff Oda is going to come into camp and be ready to win a starting job. Now, this is still an offensive line people are very excited about, including the Panthers. I mean, you still have Jordan Gross. You have Amini Silatolu, who you drafted in the second round to be your starting left guard. Khalil is still a Pro Bowl guy. And Oda, if he is healthy, has the potential to be a very, very effective right tackle, be a mauler for a running game that's just loaded with D'Angelo Williams, Jonathan Stewart, and Mike Tolbert. Not to mention Cam Newton, who's capable of doing some things with his legs too. So, you know, that it's a story that, you know, I think we'd be surprised if Byron Bell is your starting right tackle for the Panthers, an undrafted guy, but he filled in very nicely for Oda last season. Oda's only played 4 games in the past 2 years, so nobody's exactly sure what to expect. He hasn't shown he's going to come in and restore confidence that he is going to be the answer there. The guy that, you know, people who are around the team say this isn't a worker, doesn't come in good shape, and you have to respond to the talk of Rivera in any convincing fashion.
Well, you'd think the motivation for Jeff Oda would be he's entering a contract season where there aren't a lot of quality right tackles in this league, and he certainly could help himself out with a good year. Of course, the motivation for the Panthers might be, let's keep Byron Bell off the field. A lot of good moments, but also a lot of bad ones. Penalties and speed rushers kind of hurt him last year. But I want to turn the attention to that receiver position. And, you know, so much has been made about, yeah, they threw for 4,000-plus yards last season, but, you know, Steve Smith really hasn't had a running mate at wide receiver since really Musi Muhammad 1.0. I mean, you know, he went ahead a second go around. Keyshawn Johnson failed in that role. Brandon LaFell seems to have the inside track, but is there anything in the last 30 seconds or so, any traction to these rumors that Plexico Burress, who claims he wants to play for the Panthers, that they might be interested?
We're hearing the Panthers aren't interested in Burress. Now, they did take a look at Jacoby Jones this offseason before he ended up signing with the Ravens. That's a guy they looked at and kind of would have fit the mold of a guy they already have on the roster, and David Geddes is coming off an ACL tear. That's the guy who, if anyone's going to beat out Brandon LaFell for the job, it'd probably be Geddes if he comes back strong. But right now, all indications, and you know, the Panthers are pretty happy with LaFell and are hoping he has a breakout year. He sat behind Legadou Nane for pretty much all of last season, and a lot of people were scratching their heads wondering why. LaFell clearly was the better player there. So, you know, I think there's a good chance that you're going to see Brandon LaFell. You know, could they sign someone else? I won't rule it out, but Plexico Burress doesn't appear to be the guy on their radar.
All right, Dan, thank you very much for your help with those stories. We'll check back with Dan next week. Right now, a quick commercial break, and then more NFL Way We Hear It coming up in just a moment. You've got Pro Football Weekly on your radio dial. Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm are your hosts in studio. Mike Wilkening is anchoring the Pro Football Weekly hotline for us this week to the PFW offices, visiting with various members of the Pro Football Weekly editorial department. But right now, we'll stick with Wilkie and talk about the Baltimore Ravens. And Mike, you know, I personally was stunned that the Minnesota Vikings just cut Bryant McKinney loose the way they did. I understood that he was a problem child. There were issues in Minnesota, his weight, a constant battle. But he was also a Pro Bowl left tackle at one point. Ravens pick him up. He has a nice year. Not a Pro Bowl year, but a real nice year. Apparently now weight immediately the problem again. But he tells a little different story about it this time.
Yeah, it's been an interesting week or so with the Bryant McKinney situation, because I think everybody looks at McKinney and says conditioning an issue there, wasn't participating last week, you know, supposedly conditioning related. He comes out and he tells the Carroll County Times, look, he's going to be ready for camp. He's going to be in shape, that he's about 9 pounds away from his ideal playing weight. And I think that's the big concern with McKinney at this stage of his career. He's a mountainous man at left tackle. The size is his real asset. You know, very good run blocker. If he gets his hands on a pass rusher, it's probably over, but it's his ability to move, I think, is a big concern. And they need Bryant McKinney, in some sort of decent conditioning, because if you keep him around, that means that Michael Orr is at right tackle. That means you've got a pretty good tandem there. If you can't rely on Bryant McKinney, then you're looking at Ja Reed maybe kind of filling one of those spots or something or thereabouts. So the news that McKinney is vowed to get into shape, I think, is a positive. I tend to think what we saw last week we can probably move past here sooner than later. But the Ravens guys, they need Bryant McKinney to be somewhere close to decent shape to have a real shot at having a decent offensive line.
Well, I really worry about that line. I mean, guys over 30, they just signed, you know, a street guy, Bobby Williams. I mean, left guard looks like a problem. If the AFC title game is any indication, Matt Burke is a problem at center. I mean, you know, and if McKinney's falling apart at left tackle, then you got a real problem there. And all of a sudden, Joe Flacco can't do what he's hopefully getting paid to do down the line with a new contract at some point.
Yeah, and Joe Flacco is a fairly mobile guy within the pocket, but you don't want him running for his life out of the pocket. And you're right, Eric. The left guard spot is something to watch. Ben Grubbs is an above-average starter. He goes to New Orleans. You sign Bobby Williams. Now, he knows the division. Strong, good run blocker. Maybe he's the answer there. You know, Matt Burke is a guy that I think, you know, closer to the end of his career than the beginning, but, you know, can get it done, I think, still for 16 games. But, you know, over a long season, and we know, guys, they've got a tough schedule this year. How does that group hold up? They really don't have a lot of sure things. Marshall Yanda, a Pro Bowler last year, but losing Grubbs, I think, was something, a tough decision they had to make. And again, in the background here, the decisions they have to make on Ray Rice in terms of paying him, and the decision they've got to make on Joe Flacco in terms of paying him. This is a team with some good talent. You got to pay those guys. When you have to pay those guys in the salary cap era, you let guys like Grubbs go, it can have a real effect on the whole sort of outlook for the team.
All right, and I think, again, just to amplify Bryant McKinney's point, he's claiming that right now he's in better shape than he was at any point last year, and he's trying to be in the best shape he's been in at quite some time when the season begins. So we will keep a close eye on that offensive line in Baltimore. Eric, one of your clubs made news this week. The Minnesota Vikings, not news they wanted, I'm sure, but a very strange series of, I don't want to call them outbursts, a very strange series of conversations with the media from Percy Harvin, and a lot of people scratching their heads as to what's really bugging Percy.
Well, he was there, and he complained to the media and said, I'm not happy. I will not be at training camp unless certain issues are resolved. When asked what those issues are, he wouldn't say. And everybody speculated, okay, it's the money. He's making below average money the next 2 years of his contract before he gets a chance to be a free agent. I think that's part of the thing. As I've dug deeper into this and I've talked to people who know Percy, people around the Vikings, I think it's a complex issue that's multi-layered. One of the things the Vikings have tried to do is kind of protect him and keep him on the field for as many games they can. One way by doing this is sort of only having him out there for 50-60% of the plays. They're not using him on kickoffs all the time. They're not using him as a receiver all the time. He has been in the backfield, ran the ball a lot last year, but they kind of tried to preserve him a little bit, and I think that's one of the things that he wants more playing time so that he can put up the big numbers and get the chance to earn that big contract. So I think it's a combination of things. There might be some relationships that have dissolved a little bit. I think Leslie Frazier's trying to get a good hold on it. And Rick Spielman said, look, I'm not going to trade this guy. It looks at this point, after everything we've been through and this week, that Harvin will be in training camp and that he's not going to be an issue. That's my prediction at this point.
Yeah, I'm just speculating, maybe just spitballing here a little bit. But I think he's also upset finally at this point of his life. He's got to go through life with the name Percy. But, you know, that's just me. And this is coming from Herbert, so I'm just having fun here with you guys. Very quickly, Adrian Peterson, Eric, I think probably the only bigger concern for the Vikings than getting Harvin happy and having Christian Ponder develop has got to be Adrian Peterson. Where's he at?
No question. I mean, he's been running straight forward. He's now starting to cut a little bit. You know, they keep saying he's ahead of schedule. I don't even know what the schedule for an ACL is anymore. And he's a phenomenal athlete and a warrior. So the expectation in his mind is week one. He really thinks he can be back by that point. He probably needs a week or two of practice before that. But he feels very strong and confident, even if, you know, he's not ready to start doing full contact stuff yet.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. Mike, we're back with you guys in just a moment, as well as welcoming in Arthur Arkish to talk a little bit more Way We Hear It right after this. Yes, we are, and we're talking Way We Hear It around the National Football League as we welcome in Associate Editor Arthur Arkish, who covers the AFC South. And Arthur, Tennessee Titans have got their mini camp in their rearview mirrors. We are airing this program around the country, and everybody knows, I think, about the quarterback battle between Matt Hasselbeck and Jake Locker, but some significant other position battles that have really kicked off in earnest with this mini camp, and I guess it starts on the offensive line at center.
Yeah, it sure does. Eugene Amano is a guy who is absolutely going to be under the microscope this offseason. It was pretty telling when the Titans brought in five veteran free agents to for visits to the Titans facility to see if they may be an upgrade over Amano. They didn't end up signing any of them, but I don't know what more you could do to put a guy on notice. So they've been pretty obvious that Amano wasn't good enough last year. They got a couple guys, including Bruce Matthews' son, Kevin Matthews, who will be in the mix. Also Fernando Velasco, a guy who can play both guard and center, who sources on the scene tell us should have had an opportunity to play sooner, but it sounds like he's absolutely going to get a chance now. And we'll see if Amano can hold some of these guys off. We know Chris Johnson needs to do more. He also needs better blocking up front.
Yeah, and what's the situation at weak side linebacker? I mean, you've got Will Witherspoon, the veteran. He played well at times. A couple other guys, the draft pick, Zach Brown, a speedy kid out of UNC, and then this Gerald McCrath, who's been around for a few years. Any other names that we should know about at the weak side linebacker spot?
Those are the two big ones, and Will Witherspoon hasn't done a bad job. He's been a pretty good player for them. They like his veteran presence. He's a good leader, you know, in the locker room and everything, but he's not really a special player at this point of his career. They think that Zach Brown can be a great athlete, first-round talent. There were questions about his makeup. You know, they've got Akeem Ayers on the strong side, Colin McCarthy. Those are the guys they want moving forward, disrupting plays in the backfield. They need a guy who can go back in coverage. They think Zach Brown has that athleticism. Gerald McGrath hasn't really been able to make the most of his opportunities during his time in Nashville, but the coaching staff and Mike Munchak has said that he will also be in the mix and will have an opportunity to knock off Witherspoon. We'll see how that battle unfolds.
Wilkie, very quickly before we move on, you cover the Bengals, and they were in the playoffs last year, but people forget they actually had to win a tiebreaker for the Titans. The Titans were the quietest 9-7 in the NFL. What is the perception outside of Tennessee of this Titans team as far as where they're headed this year?
They're an interesting group in the sense that you've got the quarterback question has to be resolved. But overall, you're correct, Hub. This is a team that won enough games to be in the playoff mix. And to me, I think they're the only viable contender to Houston in this particular division. But I think when it comes down to it, it's going to be the quarterback situation. It's going to be Chris Johnson making more explosive plays. And I think defensively, they had a good thing going last year. And let's see if they can build off of that. I think some of the younger guys, particularly the defensive line, you'd like to see them maybe get a little more of a pass rush. But, you know, they're an interesting team. I think a team that certainly wouldn't surprise me at all if they were in the wild card mix this year.
And how many times have we seen successful rookie head coaches like Mike Munchak suffer a sophomore slump? Certainly hope that won't be the case in Tennessee because Munchak is one of the good guys. Arthur, Indianapolis Colts appear just threadbare on defense. But one player I like a lot, if he could ever stay healthy, is Jerod Powers. They know he's going to be one cornerback. What's happening on the other side?
Well, the kid who started to emerge a little bit is Kevin Thomas, the third-year player out of USC. Lost his whole rookie season to a knee injury. Spent most of last year kind of playing catch-up. He was rusty. He was just trying to get his feet wet, trying to get in the mix. Didn't have a great start to the offseason. OTAs didn't really stand out a whole lot. Perhaps prompted Ryan Griggs and Chuck Pagano to go out and make the trade for Cassius Vaughn, the kid from Denver. Really good special teams player who could also be in the mix at corner. But we hear Kevin Thomas is starting to emerge a little little bit. At the Colts minicamp last week, he had a couple near interceptions of Andrew Luck, and we hear he's starting to sort of pique the interest of the coaching staff, and he's a guy who's starting to stand out, and he's been running with the ones opposite Powers throughout the offseason, so we'll see if he's able to kind of clamp down on that spot, or if Vaughn and maybe a few other guys who maybe still aren't on the roster at this point are going to emerge and challenge for that job.
Arthur, very quickly, in Houston, folks worried about the loss of Mario Williams and D'Amico Ryans, but their replacements are already in place. Now, offensively, Andre Johnson has been one of the most durable receivers in the league until last year. Even if he comes back and is 100% this year, he's got to have help, and they're counting on some rookies to do it?
Yeah, they sure are. They, of course, drafted Devere Posey in the third round and Keyshawn Martin. What we're hearing, one of the things you may not think of with Matt Schaub not being out on the field, is there's no chemistry being built with these young receivers. And we hear that neither of these guys have had an opportunity to really jump out or get noticed yet. So it'll be curious to see how they do develop once Schaub is out there. But neither guy really receiving high praise just yet. It's actually Lester Jean, a former undrafted guy who's been getting lots of looks with Andre Johnson sidelined. So we know what Kevin Walter is at this point. Of course, we know what Andre Johnson is when he's healthy, but they do need more more talent and someone to take the pressure off of Johnson and Schaub.
Arthur, thank you very much. We take a quick commercial break here, and then we're back with some more NFC East talk, as well as additional issues for the NFLPA. It's all coming up. More NFL Way We Hear It. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, and Mike Wilkening visiting with you right now. And Eric, the Dallas Cowboys on your beat. And it seems like every couple of weeks we've got to try and convince people that Tony Romo is either more than he is or is getting less credit than he should.
Yeah.
And Jason Witten seems to like to take that job on a lot, too. And I guess this week during the Cowboys minicamp for OTAs, he was bending the ear of some of the of a number of members of the Cowboys media trying to sell that Tony Romo is absolutely an elite quarterback in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, here's my thing, is you got to define the word elite. You know, if we're talking about, finance, if we're talking about the arts, if we're talking about football, you've got to define elite. What are we saying? Top 10% of their field? 5, 15%? I don't know. I mean, but it's a pretty small percentage. So if it's 10 and we're going that assumption, that means there are, what, 3 or 4 quarterbacks who belong in that discussion. And I think most people would agree that Tony is probably just a shade below that. Even Eli Manning, who had a career-high season, a season a year ago, 4,900-plus yards, won his second Super Bowl. There's still people who question whether he's an elite quarterback. So this is just one of those things. I mean, Witten and Romo are good buddies off the field. Of course, he's going to defend his guy. That said, I've been accused of being a Romo apologist. I like his game. I think he's got some unique skills, and I think he's due for another big season. He was great last year, especially the last 12 games.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he's 47-30 as a starter. Yeah. He's got a 96.9 career passer rating. Only Aaron Rodgers is better at this point in the league on his career rating. And yet, at the end of the day, I don't see how you can be elite, not only without a ring, but maybe without a few rings. And I know Rodgers has only got one, but he's trending towards more. It is completely unclear as to whether Romo is trending in that direction or not.
Right, and I think it's the same discussion. You know, I mean, people still think Philip Rivers has a good chance. I think there are a lot of people who think Michael Vick can lead the Eagles there if he stays healthy. Not as many people think Romo, maybe outside of Dallas, maybe it's the case, but I think most people would say that because they have this idea that he's not this clutch guy, that he's prone to these crazy mistakes at the end of games, or, you know, just killer mistakes, that he's never going to lead them to a title. I think he's got the opportunity this season, but he's 32. The window's closing a little bit. It's going to be fascinating to see what they do with him in a couple of years contract-wise.
All right, guys. This story on Wednesday of this past week from the retired NFL players, 20 former NFL players, including 7 Hall of Famers, have signed a letter requesting that the NFLPA, their Players Association, be expelled from the AFL-CIO. And basically the grievance details the union's continued failure, according to these players, in its, quote, moral obligation to retired players. The letter emphasizes that for years the NFLPA has acknowledged the growing gap in the needs of its retired player members and the current benefits programs under the NFL retirement system, which in material part was the result of the NFLPA's history of sacrificing and subordinating the interests and needs of the retirees to advantage its member active players. Wilkie, it's a tough one, because the retired players, on one hand, probably deserve more based on the incredible success of the game today and what many of them who've been retired 10, 15, 20 years or longer received. But at the same time, it's the same in almost every industry. As a business grows, benefits improve, and the people who were there earlier don't necessarily get the advantage of that.
Yeah, you can see it both ways. The union, in my estimation, has done a better job in recent years with regards to doing the necessary and right things by the guys who played this game, who paved the way for today's stars. I think it's a process that's still ongoing. I think if you would ask the union, they would say the same thing. I think you can always try to get more benefits for past and present members. I think when you look at what the union has done, we can go at this forever and ever about the last CBA, and clearly the union probably could have done a better job. We're not privy to everything that goes on in the room there. Certainly they got a deal done where the membership in 2011 could play the game of football, could make an obviously very, very good living, far better than the membership got a generation or two generations ago. I just tend to think there's always going to be the tug, the push and pull between former members that played the game or current members of the union still, the past and present. There's always going to be that tug. And how much can you do for the former players? And I tend to think the union has got to continue to be responsive to that. I think you've got to take care of the guys that played this game that paved the way for today's game.
Guys, this problem actually goes back to Gene Upshaw in 2007. He said of the retired players, "They didn't hire me and they can't fire me. I work for the active players." D. Smith talking about doing more, but so far it hasn't happened. They do have to do more in terms of benefits for players who are suffering today, either medically or financially. Quick commercial break here. AFC East is next. Hub Arkish, Eric Edholm, and Mike Wilkening visiting with you for Pro Football Weekly. We now welcome in Associate Editor Kevin Fishbane. Kevin's got the AFC East. And Kevin, in Buffalo, I know you had a chance to talk this week with offensive line coach Joe Alessandris. And interesting guy, I think, because as recently as 2 years ago, a lot of people thought the Bills' offensive line was one of the biggest problems with that football team. Last year, they led the NFL in fewest quarterback sacks allowed. Awfully quick turnaround. Is it complete? Can they run the football? Where is this offensive line really at?
Well, the one thing that he credited to, obviously, is it's a very close-knit group in there. You got a lot of young guys. I think Eric Wood, the center, Andy Levitra, left guard, are two of the most underrated O-linemen in the league, and they paved big holes for Fred Jackson and C.J. Spiller last year. The big question, though, is that left tackle spot, and who's going to take it? Is it going to be the rookie Cordy Glenn, who took a lot of first-team snaps in minicamp, or last year's rookie Chris Harrison, who kind of got thrust into things, didn't play that well in place of Demetrius Bell? But, you know, Coach D'Alessandris was very high on both those players and everything they have going there. It also does help when you have a guy like Ryan Fitzpatrick who gets rid of the ball pretty quickly.
All right, Kevin, I'm interested in Miami. One thing that the Dolphins have done well, in spite of all their problems, is rush the passer, specifically because of Cameron Wake. But they really are going to have to find somebody to take the pressure off Wake. And like so many other positions, it's something they've been struggling with recently.
Yeah, it has. You know, 2 years ago they drafted Koa Misi with that hope, and he had a few sacks as a rookie, but never really came into that. And then Jason Taylor was the guy last year opposite Wake, and he had a pretty good season in his last year in the NFL. But they really wanted more pressure players in the front seven. It's something Jeff Ireland really stressed when he talked to the media at the Senior Bowl and at the Combine. And they're really excited about Jared Odrick, and a lot of people close to the team will tell you that Odrick's got a lot of upside. You know, he missed almost all of his rookie season, was a little banged up last year, but still put up six sacks, and he's looking very good in minicamp. Other guy to keep an eye on is Olivier Vernon, the defensive end slash linebacker out of University of Miami, third-round pick by the Dolphins, and he's a guy that's also kind of impressed in minicamp. He even got a little scuffle with Jake Long, so certainly he has some guts if you're going to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, anybody who wants to pick a fight with Jake Long is crazy enough to play on my defense, I'll tell you that. Wilkie, if we look at these Dolphins, yeah, they'll rush the passer, Reggie Bush will do a few things, but this is still pretty clearly a team in significant transition.
Yeah, I think they're in a tough spot in this division. I look at them, and I just think that they're going to have their moments. They did last year. I mean, I think how hard they played for Tony Sperano down the stretch, how sound they were, how they righted the ship after such a bad start, I think was, you know, a storyline that maybe didn't get enough attention. You know, Matt Moore played great, but he's having to compete for his job. I just don't know if they've got enough playmakers on offense. And, you know, I think we've seized upon a key point with them. You've got Cameron Wake. He's an elite pass rusher. where are the playmakers on that defense otherwise? Where are the playmakers on this team otherwise? I tend to think they're just not going to be able to make enough splash plays in a division where the top three teams look very, very good.
Kevin, the Denver Broncos have got an interesting situation. All the conversation for months now on the offense, obviously because Peyton Manning is coming aboard. But you look at what Mike McCoy was able to do last year, the offensive coordinator, of course, with Tim Tebow. And now he's got Peyton Manning. And Manning is almost like having another quarterback or another offensive coordinator, offensive coach on the football field. So you've got Jack Del Rio, who's been a head coach the last 7 years, getting back to his defensive coordinator days. I wonder if head coach John Fox isn't going to be the guy really running that defense this year.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, as you mentioned, what Peyton does is it allows John Fox, he doesn't really have to worry about the offense at all. You know, he can work with Del Rio and focus on the defense, but, you know, it's a question of how much does he really have to do. Del Rio is going to implement a more aggressive scheme for that Broncos defense and one that can help complement Peyton. I mean, we saw in Indianapolis when the Colts were able to kind of unleash those pass rushers in Mathis and Freeney, and the Broncos have two guys who could do that in Von Miller and Elvis Dumervil, but they need to improve that pass defense. They made a lot of moves in free agency to do so, because if they're going to have leads thanks to Peyton Manning, they're going to need to stop the pass much better than they did last season.
Eric, very quickly, there were times last year when the Broncos appeared on the verge of becoming an elite defense. There were other times when they were giving up 40, 45 points.
Yeah, I mean, there were stretches where they were very, very good, like you said, under 20 points. But, I mean, they still have to, they have to answer the question of the defensive tackle. They've got a kid named Silver Siligut. If you could tell me anything about him, I'd be impressed. But he's running first team at defensive tackle right now. Weak side linebacker might be at middle linebacker. I mean, so, yeah, a lot of positions they still have to figure out before they're going to be a good defense.
Well, if Siligo picks a fight with Jake Long, I'll like him a lot. Guys, we're out of time on this one. We got to take one more quick commercial break, but we've still got more. The Publisher's Pen is up next.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. And we talked a lot about this in the opening segment of the show, but my fear is that you and Mike Wilkley and I are so passionate about it, we may have confused things a little more than we clarified them. So I want to go one more time to what I believe is the problem with the current status of Bountygate and the appeals of the four players, Jonathan Vilma, Anthony Hargrove, Will Smith, and Scott Fujita, and the mess that the NFL is making for itself public relations-wise. Now, these players claim that they're being suspended and penalized unfairly. Whether they are or not, I don't know. Nobody knows but Roger Goodell. Their claim is that there was no due process, that they don't have enough of the evidence that the league used to penalize them, and they're saying even if some of that evidence exists, the penalties are too harsh. They're not necessarily entitled to the evidence. This is not a court case. This is a commissioner in an NFL front office that was given the power to suspend and punish players for breaking the rules. The issue I have is with Roger Goodell and the NFL owners, at what point is somebody going to say enough is enough? Now, Eric pointed out, correctly so, they're in no mood to do anything for the players right now because the players keep taking shots at them. But somebody's got to put a stop to this for the best interest of the game. Supposedly, the suspensions are in the best interest of the game. Well, having Roger Goodell both make the punishment and hear the appeals is flat out wrong, and it's time for the commissioner to be the bigger man and say we're going to change this system into something that works better for both sides. That does it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks, as always, to Randy Meyer. Great job engineering and producing. Our home studio is Syndication Network, and most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. Join us again next week, same time, same station, for Pro Football Weekly.